All right, so we're continuing on with discussions with YAL 2012 speakers. Welcome back, Tony. I remember you from last year. Tony Morris.
Runar Bjarnason.
Excellent. And we're going to talk about functional programming.
Yeah.
So that's kind of a broad topic.
It sure is.
Yeah. So what's going on these days, Tony?
Functional programming has become quite popular. A lot of beginners are now looking to learn the techniques using functional programming and how they can apply it in their everyday job.
Okay.
And I enjoy helping them out with that.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And you're in the Haskell camp, right?
I use Haskell for teaching.
Okay.
Because I think it's the most effective way to teach functional programming. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, we find that Haskell is it has sort of the most pure way of expressing functional concepts. There's not a lot of noise that gets in the way of sort of teaching the concept to somebody.
Okay.
Whereas if you try to do that in, say, Java, where I first picked up functional programming, there's a lot of type noise in your way. You know, you got objects and things that, so there's just a lot of code that doesn't have anything to do with your actual program.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, the thing is, like, what we're also seeing in the imperative languages spaces is functional concepts that are finding their ways into C#, for example, in the form of link.
Yep.
Which is actually a monad.
Yeah, yeah. Monad. It's a comprehension for monadic computation.
There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, here's the thing. Developers shouldn't really have to ever care about that. I mean, that's sort of the argument I'm going to put forth for this discussion. Who cares if it's a monad?
That is actually a really good question. So unfortunately, C# developers can't exploit the full power of monads by nature of the type system in C#. So the answer to why should I care if it's a monad is that it gives you an enormous library if you are able to express that. So C# is not able to do it. Haskell and Scala are able to do it. Just by nature of their type system. So it's a monad is simply an interface, and from that interface you can derive a very useful and large library.
Yeah, so there's a number of functions that you can write once and for all monads. And if you look at the type signature of one of these functions, and it'll say, oh, it requires my structure to be a monad, and you know that the thing that you have as a monad, you know that you could pass it to one of these functions.
Yeah. Taking link as the example, I could actually give you a link comprehension out loud. Say, like, from X in A, from Y in B, select FX of Y. If I was to ask a C# developer what is the type of that expression, they would have to appeal to something specific like IEnumerable interface or IQueryable. And the power of monads is that you can abstract on that thing and you can go, well, it's just anything with a select many method. And then you can write a whole bunch of libraries because it's got a select many method. So that's kind of the... You do get a monad comprehension syntax in C#, but you don't get the benefit of the libraries, which is actually the really important part.
Interesting. So, but you do... I mean, let's kind of, like, talk about that a little bit more.
Sure.
Because... And obviously, there's tons of libraries you can use from any number of imperative languages. What you're talking about is libraries based on a specific monad?
On the monad interface, yeah.
The monad
interface. And then you can run it on all the different monads. So that expression will work with IEnumerable, IQueryable, and many other monads, state, continuations, option, and so on. It's just that if I was to actually write that comprehension in C#, I'd have to do it for each and every one of those, and that list is quite long. And then I'd have to do that for all the different library functions as well, so I end up with like an M by N problem. Mm. I would like it just to be constant, where I just write the function once, and then it works on all monads. And then I just build libraries and libraries all the way up, usually all the, you know, up somewhere near the main function eventually, and then I go, right, I want to run this in state or IO or whatever it is I want to run.
Yeah, the thing that languages like Haskell and Scala allow you to do is to be polymorphic in a type constructor. It allows you to be polymorphic over the structure itself. So, you know, if you have something that's written over a list or written over, you know, an IEnumerable or a state or a continuation or something, you can write code that is polymorphic in that container type or that structure type.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, you mentioned, you know, clearly functional programming is becoming, well, I mean, we started this whole functional programming thing, I don't know, in the imperative mainstream programming languages anyway, back in, I don't know, what was it, like 2006 or something, where we started talking about monads and stuff like that, and Eric was working on kind of infusing functional constructs into C Sharp.
Yep.
It seems to me, though, for the bulk developer, for the average developer, I mean, are you finding, trying to teach them how to think differently, because that's exactly what you're doing.
Yep.
Are you finding resistance? Are you finding, like, you know, is the right strategy to go just use a functional programming language or to evolve mainstream imperative functional programming language or imperative languages, stick more functional things in them? All, and I don't know, does Java have lambdas?
I mean, you can implement lambdas in Java. That's how I first got introduced to functional programming. Is you know, you can write an interface that is polymorphic in sort of an input type and an output type, and it has one method that takes a value of the input type and produces a value of the output type, and that's just that's a lambda. That's a first class function. So you can accomplish this in Java, but you know, it's not very nice.
No, it's also kind of nice to have it in the language semantics itself.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like putting some basic functional stuff into, because, I mean, when you use link, you're passing a lambda to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
It's a very functional kind of thing to do.
It is. In terms of teaching, so I don't see too much resistance. That just might be my bias. Mm-hmm. If you're resistant, there's not much I can do, and so I kind of move on. Mm-hmm. In terms of should we just sort of go to the hardcore sort of Haskell, or should we introduce it slowly? I think it's best to introduce people just with, you know, what is functional programming, the essence of it, and put aside all of this thing that's going on with C Sharp and Java, and give them the principles, and then if they'd like to go to C Sharp and with those principles and view C Sharp through, you know, through well-educated principles, then that's for them to work out. Going the other way, in my experience, has been a very clumsy way to get to the result, okay, which is principled thought in functional programming.
So, I mean, let's talk about this. So, you know, let's get it out on the table. Why? I mean, what's the big deal with functional programming? I mean, it's like,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
You know, great.
That's the question, right?
Yeah. So, what is it?
So, well, there's consequences of functional programming, and I think the consequences they certainly appeal to me, and I think they would appeal to other people as well, and that is that. I get greater guarantees that my program's going to work, which is really cool, especially on Fridays, because I don't want to sit there and fix bugs. And I can do it quickly. I can build libraries from smaller libraries, and eventually I have libraries that I can rely on, and I know that they're going to work. And I'm not going to find out, you know, next week just before deployment that actually there's a bug way down here, and I'm sure everyone's familiar with this situation.
Sure.
And it's just a deep aversion to that problem that compels me to do functional programming.
Yeah, and I think you end up with functional programming if you start doing things like avoiding side effects, first of all. So if you avoid side effects, you avoid a large class of bugs, because you can reason about your programs algebraically. You can reason about them as if they were expressions, you know? So you can use the substitution model to figure out what should be the result of this program. And you eliminate code duplication and you know, on and on. And you just use good software engineering principles. And I think you will end up with, you will invent functional programming if you just kind of keep doing that.
Interesting. But side effects are good, right?
Sure, yeah.
Side effects are great.
Sure.
And you know, one of the problems that you imagine, like when you think about, oh, I want to, you know, in Haskell anyway, I want to, like, you know, do some I/O, right?
Yeah.
Oh, perform safe I/O. I use the I/O monad.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. You got to be very careful about what you mean when you say side effect. Are you talking about a side effect, or are you talking about an effect? Mm. Because a side effect is something that, you know, happens that violates referential transparency. So when you call you know, a function passing in an argument that has a side effect, then calling that function with the result of, you know, evaluating that the argument instead. You know, you evaluate the argument first, and then you pass it to the function, or you pass it to the function and then evaluate the argument. So if that matters, then you've violated referential transparency. And so what happens this.
Side effect versus effect.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so side effect versus effect.
Dude, that's actually a great in situ reality of the complexity, with the conceptual complexity of functional programming in terms of, you know, Gilad Braca has a really interesting blog post out now. For Gilad is right now, just to add, before we continue with the side effect versus effect,
sure.
We just kind of witnessed this notion of inherent conceptual complexity at the functional level, in quotes, right? Functional meaning like the useful meaningness of something.
Mm-hmm.
The term monad and a lot of this sort of computer science complexity that was developed by the gang of people who invented this stuff, who were computer scientists and mathematicians.
Yeah.
In some sense, that can get in the way of just writing code.
Yes.
To get something done algorithmically. Like, you don't really need to know what a monad is.
Totally.
To use a monad to benefit from it.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And referential transparency in terms like this, which are, you know, they're very valid and very important. But it's interesting because, you know, we were talking about what all of us can understand in this room and people watching it, which are side effects and effects.
Mm-hmm.
So let's get back to that. I just wanted to throw that out there. People should read Gilad's latest blog post on Do Monads Really Matter?
Okay.
All right.
And anyway, Gilad's a very opinionated person, as you know.
Oh, I know. Yes.
So let's talk about the side effect versus effect.
So yeah. So
okay.
So when you want to have some effect, when you want the computer to, you know, actually do something,
yes.
Right? Which sounds useful, right?
Yeah.
So it's a question of, do you go and do it right there and then? Like, you know, are you're computing 10+2, and you also, you know, write to a file. Do you go and do that right now, or do you return from your function a description of what it is that you want to do, so that you can then later compose that effect with another effect, and then sort of at the end of the end of the world, you know, where your program is actually being evaluated by an outside system, you pass that system sort of an imperative program that then actually has the effects.
Okay.
But if your program can't be aware of any of those effects, like if it can't see the effects of those effects, mm-hmm. then they're not side effects. You know, you are returning a program that performs those effects later.
Yeah.
So that makes sense.
The program, say write file, whatever the file might be, could be thought of as an I/O program. Mm. And so languages like Haskell model it in the types as that thing, and it just becomes a value, just like an integer or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a value that you can pass around, and you might even transform it. You might even say, actually, after you've written to that file, I want you to go and read this other file, and then you get a new I/O program, and you can take these values and compose them together as you need to do, and eventually you say, well, here's my whole description of what to do in terms of I/O, and now please run it. And I would argue that Haskell is probably one of the most practical languages for doing I/O because of this reason, in that you've got first class I/O values. And you can manipulate them in, there's really good library support for doing this, and you can manipulate them in all the different ways that we do I/O with. Mm-hmm. Whereas in languages without that first class support, it's just, you know, here's the instruction, you will do this at this point, and here's the next thing to do now.
Mm-hmm.
And transforming it is, you know, becomes clumsy.
Interesting. But I mean, what's the brass tacks here? I mean, you build composable systems, you build reliable systems, you can build composable and reliable systems using imperative code.
Well, so. I would say that, there's not really a dichotomy between functional and imperative programming.
Yeah.
You know, Haskell is one of the most powerful imperative programmings there is, and it's purely functional. Because, you know, you can write imperative looking, at least, programs that, you know, work in the I/O monad, essentially. So you just say, do this and then that and then that, and you're constructing one of these I/O data structures, rather than actually running those things.
Okay.
And the benefit is compositionality. It's better reliability.
I can give you an example on the whiteboard if you like.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. So suppose we've got this I/O program. Should I turn this around a bit or?
Yes.
All right.
Just a little. That's good. Perfect.
Okay. So we might have some I/O program. Okay. And I'm just going to hand wave what it does. I'll leave it up to the imagination. Right. So. And it just produces values of type A. Let me fix that.
I think the red one is the one going to work for you.
All right.
There? Yeah.
I'll start again.
Talk a little bigger. Like, draw a little bigger.
A little bigger. All right. So suppose we've got some I.O. program, and it produces values of some type, and I'll leave it up to your imagination to determine what that type might be. It's pretty easy to think of an I.O. program. And what we want to do is we want to compose that with another I.O. program, but before we do, we want to take the result of this I.O. program and use it to compute the next I.O. program. Okay, so this could be, say, read the file, and here are the file contents, and then we want to take the contents of that file to a new I.O. program that produces some new value, which, again, I'll leave it up to the imagination.
Like the number of lines in the file.
Yeah, the number of lines. So this can be the file contents. Actually, that would be a pure function.
Oh, right.
So
let's say that one of them is a file that contains a bunch of file names, and then the other one concatenates all those files.
Right. So this would read a file with all the file names. So we would have all the file names here. So then we given a function that takes all those file names to a new I.O. program that concatenates all those files, we have the result of that being an I.O. program that composes those two things together. Mm-hmm. And this one here got to look at the result of this I.O. program to get its result. And C# programmers out there will recognize this function signature as select many. Okay, so where this would be IEnumerable of A and then takes a method A to IEnumerable B and returns an IEnumerable B, for example. Okay. So this idea of composing in this particular pattern is really not as foreign as is often made out. So people are using monadic, this is a monad, using monadic computation all the time. And the course that Runar and I are doing actually on Thursday, what we do is we euphemize the name monad, and the attendants, they will actually accidentally invent monads, and then we'll just tell them the real words. And it wasn't that hard after all.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But then again, it's like you can, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier, you're doing this anyway in C#. It doesn't matter that it's a monad. It's sort of the point
that
people are making. It really doesn't matter. It matters to Simon, Faith, and Jones. It matters perhaps to people such as yourselves. But for end user developers, it just doesn't matter.
Well,
that's the argument. I'm not stating my position. I'm stating that that's a fair argument because that's IEnumerable and I use it in C#, and it really doesn't look
like
that.
Yeah, but
I think it really depends on how deeply you want
to
go.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, to some extent you care. Yeah. And you're welcome to stop caring at that point, and that's okay.
And if you're writing,
but I'm going to beat you to the finish line. That's the consequence of that. So, sorry, man.
No. Yeah, if you're implementing a library that is, you know, that happens to be monadic, you end up caring. But if you're the user of such a library, you may not care. But you know, it depends on how deep you want to go in your development.
Cool. How far down the rabbit hole you want to go?
Yeah.
Understood.
I mean, it's not one size fits all.
Totally. And I think that's sort of, I think the one of the problems we have is when we're kind of, when you push functional programming out there as sort of, this is just the greatest thing in the world, it guarantees safety, it guarantees controllable side effects, compositionality, you know, you can build highly modular systems where you aren't going to impact, can't bring the whole house down because you want to remodel the kitchen, that kind of stuff. The moral of the story is you can actually take some of that and stick it into languages that people actually can wrap their heads around.
Yeah.
And you know, use the right tool for the job.
Yeah. Right? At the end of the day, it's our job to, you know, as developers of languages and of tools and libraries, to make this easy to understand, to make it digestible and useful.
Good. Right? So I like the idea of not telling people using the term monad when in fact you're inventing one with everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, what we call them, misties, something like that? No.
Well, that's fine. People won't see this by Thursday. Cool, man. So interesting. It's good to see that, you know, functional is still kind of cranking out there. You're using it in the industry and certainly in the financial industry. And I guess people
You need to get to the finish line really quickly there, right?
Right on. So when you say you really need to get to the finish line quickly, you have the conceptual complexity overhead that you have to get over first.
Yeah, that's right.
Then you can get to the
finish line quickly. So you need your program to work, because if not, you will lose a lot of money, right?
Yes.
And you also need to beat the other guy to the finish line. That's is what a lot of financial systems are about. Mm. And this is what functional programming is really good at.
Yeah. So Tony says to me, he says, what you got to do is not fail. Mm-hmm. And if you do that consistently, you're going to end up a functional programmer.
Right on. Well, yeah. On that note, thanks for your time. It was great to catch up again.
Yeah, you too,
and,
man.
And people out there, of course, who are watching this, or developers, I'm sure they've played around with plenty of functional programs. But it's nice to see this, you know, the world where we have big time generic general purpose programming language starting to learn from functional programming and giving some people who don't want to perhaps go fully functional some of the good power that you guys take for granted or that you really leverage and exploit.
Yeah, and if anyone's got any questions, we're always happy to help them out, and
right,
because we like learning from other people too, so we need to get people doing it. And
cool.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Right on. Well,
all right.
Take care, you
thanks,
guys.
Man.
Thank you.
Cheers.